You know, that kind of sounds like spring is coming, not exactly like right now where their birds are going away a little bit. Charlie, what's up?
I did throw in a recording from May just because, the sun is setting early. Things seem kind of dark out there, and sometimes you just need to hear a little bit of springtime bring her back up.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with me. You're listening to the Season Watch podcast. Thank you for being with us. That's Charlie Mitchell.
That's Heidi Holden.
And we're here connecting you to nature and all the things that are happening. And even if you're someone like Charlie who needs to think about spring right now, gray skies, because November is the cloudiest month out there. For some reason, I'm embracing this sort of less light sort of thing and all the cool things that are happening. So there we go. We got a lot to talk about this week. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of good things about the sun setting earlier. We get to see more critters. So a lot of our Minnesota critters like to be out at dawn and dusk. They are crepuscular. And now that, the sunset and sunrise are closer together, we're out more during dawn and dusk. So we're more likely to see things. And we get to see the northern lights.
Yeah, we've got more on that later. What a cool thing. I do want to say thank you to the folks who are listening. Deer hunting season still going on, and there were people listening from the deer stand to the Season Watch pod. We love that. And one thing we would love would be for you to record some sound and send it our way from the deer stand, because maybe they didn't get their deer last week.
Yes, please. I would love that. One of the things that I like am very envious about of, because I don't hunt yet, is that it's just such a great excuse to sit outside quietly in the forest.
Yeah.
Same thing with fishing. Another great reason to sit outside quietly.
For
Watch what's
sure.
happening.
So, this time of the month is when we get a chance on the KXC Morning Show to talk to Pam Perry, one of our favorites. And she was talking about so many different things. About one of the things I loved and got worried about myself was one of your favorite things, the tree frogs, and how a couple had gotten in her house because she brought her house plants back in. She could hear the sound, she didn't know where they were, and she's trying to figure that out because she doesn't want them to not to die. She's got to figure out how to get them back out there so they can find their leaf piles and put on the antifreeze in their body.
Yeah, because I mean, that kind of dormancy is really important. It's like a animal's version of power saving mode, or like, that we low power mode that we have on our phones. And yeah, if they're inside, they might be awake and looking healthier than a
Yeah.
frogsicle looks when it's frozen solid in the leaf litter. That's valuable energy that they're using up, and they really need that time of sleep, just like we all do.
Yeah, we're watching the seasons. It's Season Watch Pod, a production of KEXE, and I like the idea of we're heading into the season of sort of low power.
Yeah.
But Pam also really wanted to talk about cranes
Yes,
this time.
sandhill cranes. Beautiful animals.
I love cranes, and I know you don't see as many in the forested areas, the Northeast, as we do in this area, which I consider more central Minnesota. But last Friday, a friend of mine called me and he said, Pam, he's from Crosby. He said, I had to go to Aiken, and he's a birder. So any trip out anywhere, you always go check something. And he went up County Road 1 north of Aiken. He said there were 300 cranes in the field up there.
Oh, my
He
word.
said they're staging. So that was Friday. And staging means they're gathering from small groups, family groups, into bigger groups. And then they're going to head south. And they will figure out, and they'll go in a big flock heading out. And of course, they gather at Crane Meadows, south of Little Falls. Crane Meadows National Wildlife Refuge, and then Sherburn National Wildlife Refuge further south is known for large numbers of cranes. And many people go and visit there just to see the cranes and see that many at a time. So I was thinking about that, and that was Friday. And then we had cold weather over the weekend
I noticed.
and a little snow, and I thought, I bet they left. I bet they left. And so where do they go? A lot of cranes winter in Florida, Texas, some in the other southern states where there's appropriate, suitable habitat, which is wet prairie, marshes with vegetation, you know, where they can find food and do that. And when I lived in Florida, and now this is when I was in graduate school down at the University of Florida in Gainesville, there was an area called Payne's Prairie, just south of Gainesville. And it was a wet prairie area, and it had a lot of wildlife. And the cranes came down there in huge numbers. And when they left in the spring, we knew it. You know, it was spring and Florida was going to get hot, but they were going to where it was going to be nice, and then they would nest up here. I just think sandhill cranes are really cool. Everyone knows what they look like. They're grayish. They have some red on the top of their heads. They're 3 to 4 feet tall. They'll live 20 to 35 years.
Wow.
Long time. I know where they nest around this area, just south of Brainerd, over to the east. I see cranes all summer long, spring, summer, into the fall, and then now I think they're gone.
Everyone knows what a sandhill crane looks like.
I know. When she was saying that, I'm like, oh, do I? I think I do. I think I do know what she's talking about. But I love that she's once again, she gave us some ideas of where to go if we want to see these big cranes, because paying attention to this change in seasons.
Absolutely. And my wife heard one today.
Oh.
And I think that's generally true, even if you don't necessarily see the cranes, if you don't know how to identify a crane, you will definitely hear them during migration season. And they have just a spectacular dinosaur-like call, which I think is very fun, because they are also a very ancient group of birds, evolutionarily speaking. And so the fact that they sound like a dinosaur just lines up perfectly for me. But yeah, they're such cool birds.
Did you know that they lived that long?
I think she said 25 to 35 years. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's spectacularly long-lived bird.
Yeah, for sure. Uh-huh. I mean, I guess that's something I am curious about, right? Where, how long do other birds, you know, I don't know that. Well, maybe that's something we'll take up at another time.
Yeah, I know one of the resources that I often use when I'm looking up bird facts is Cornell Lab of Ornithology's website. It's called All About Birds, no spaces, allaboutbirds.org. And they, for every species, have average lifespan, or the oldest recorded bird, as part of their like fun facts. So that's always fascinating for me.
We've been honing in on a Wilson snipe down on our shoreline that we're watching. That is digging.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that is digging for the invertebrates, is what I learned on Merlin. And what it's doing down there, but with the really long bill. And that's been really fun for us this season, or this last week or so.
That's really cool. Apparently a bunch of those shorebirds, their bill is actually like, they can move the tip of it a little bit, like up and down, not just like a little finger.
Right. It looks like not a bill, but it looks like it's a tool for them, right?
Yeah.
Like it's doing the work. I mean, I guess I don't know. It's just so much longer than you're used to seeing, and also vaguely prehistoric to me.
Yes. Yeah. But like, I always see like a bird beak or a bird bill as something like hard and that you wouldn't be able to change the shape of. And so it blew my mind a little bit. How do you move? I still don't really understand, because a bill is made out of keratin, the same stuff that our fingernails are made out of. And so how do you change the shape of keratin? Anyways, I'm fine. Geeking out.
Are you? Okay.
A little bit.
Do we know for sure that every bill is made of keratin? I mean, what if it's made of something else on the Wilson snipe? I don't know.
Oh, Heidi, this is going to be a whole new curiosity deep dive for me that I'm going to embark on.
Is it like the cartilage you talked about last week with jumping in the pile and of the leaf pile? I mean, I know that's probably, this is non-scientific me, but just posing some more curiosity. What did you call it? The curiosity helix? No, what did you call it?
Hydra. You can chop off one head and five more grow
exactly.
up.
Exactly. We just opened up about seven more. So that's always fun.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay.
So an internal bony structure covered by made out of bone, covered by a hard, shiny outer layer of keratin. But in some species, the keratin can be soft and leathery.
Ah.
And that seems like something that you would be able to flex up and down.
Sure.
Hmm.
Interesting stuff. So,
okay, more on this next week when inevitably Google.
So we were thrilled this week because we got a message on SpeakPipe. Let's take a listen.
Yeah.
Hi, Charlie and Heidi. Love the podcast. Thank you so much for putting this out there. And I'm wondering if I can open up another question here for you. I am wondering about peak color. It seems around Stillwater here, we've had peak color ending around October 28th or 29th, pretty close to Halloween for the past 5 years, from 21 until 2025. And but the preceding 7 years, from 2014 to 2020, we had dates where the peak color was ending October 20th or 21. So a full 8 days earlier for those 7 years. So I'm just wondering if you see anything in your data or in John Latimer's data, or if there's something else that's been happening for the past 5 years that's very different from those preceding seven, or just a wondering. Thanks so much for being there.
Well, now you're the head of data on this podcast. What do you know? Who'd you find it out from, Charlie?
So what I found out from was from John Latimer. He has a lot of his data available through the University of Minnesota's SeasonWatch website. It's seasonwatch.umn.edu if you want to go check it out. And so I was looking at some of his data there, and then he also sent me his updated data, including 2025. And for the red maple, for instance, you have all of these different dates scattered across a graph, and it's definitely trending later and later each year by about 6 days. But one of the things that I really noticed about the graph was in the years of like 1985 through 2015 or so, trying to think of the way to say this, it isn't unnecessarily confusing. So you have the average, right? And you have variations from the average. So you were 5 days later than average 1 year and like 4 days earlier than average the next year. They all kind of vary around a normal point. Once you get into those later years of 2015 through 2025, the amount that like a year might vary from that average gets a lot wider. So instead of being off by like 3 or 4 days, it becomes off by 8 or 9 days, plus or minus. Yeah, as time goes on, it seems like we have a lot more really early or really late than we used to. And yeah, also, generally speaking, the average is getting later by about 6 days in John's data, 8 or 9 in Josh's from Stillwater. So that's considerable.
Yes, it is. And that's showing that there is change out there. The climate is changing. It's affecting lots of different things. We're watching on this Season Watch Nature Nerds Unite podcast here. We're watching what's happening out there. And smart person there calling in to us from Stillwater area. Josh, thank you for that. And
Josh is one of the educators at the Bellwin, I think it's Environmental Science Center, but I could have that wrong. Bellwin, near Afton. And he's one of the other instructors for the Phenology in Minnesota Schools program, which is how I know him. But yeah, great, great educator, and clearly has been keeping a lot of data. So thank you.
You can leave a voice memo too through SoundPipe. Find a link for it on our website for this podcast or through your podcast platform. So that got us, of course, thinking about more changes as we're heading into the low power wintry sort of season. One of the things Latimer talked about this week kind of piqued your interest.
Yeah, he was talking, so I was already kind of primed for this from Josh's voice memo. John was talking a little bit about first snow and how that's changed over the years he's been watching nature.
We had snow on Friday night, Saturday, and I measured it at about half an inch, and it melted out to about 0.02 inches of moisture, but there was snow cover on the ground, pretty much universal at my house. And this probably, I think the snow staying on the ground, snow falling and remaining, the average date for that is the 11th of November. And that date is, by the way, getting pushed back. That is, Bob Konzemius and I have sort of compared notes, and in the recent years, that is early December now before we really get first accumulations of snow that then remain on the ground. First quarter inch accumulation of snow averages October 5th. this year, not until November 7th or 8th.
That's quite a difference.
Right? About a month difference for your first snow, from October 5th being the average to November 7th this year. That's considerable. And when he's talking about, you know, the first snow that hits the ground and sticks, he said that was from, the average used to be about November 11th and has transitioned to early December. So that's another considerable shift.
Right. I was trying to get, we're going to hear from Tornado Bob Kinzemius on this pod in a bit, but I was trying to get out of Bob because he is a meteorologist. He doesn't work as a, you know, he used to be a TV meteorologist. He does not do that anymore. But that's what his PhD is in. But a lot of people have a bone to pick with him because I tried to put him on the spot, say, when do you think, let's put a wager on the table, man, about when you think you'll first cross country ski. And he thought it wouldn't be till late December when snow was made at Itasca, Mount Itasca. But then I've got, you know, fellow staff members here saying the National Weather Service is saying it's going to be a snowier year and a colder year. And that's not what Bob is saying. And maybe that makes you happy that you're not a meteorologist, because it seems like science-wise, it's a hard one to predict.
Yes. And I think both meteorologists, climatologists have very, very hard job to begin with, predicting what's going to happen in the future with something that is extremely complex. But also the messaging of climate change can be so difficult, because even if we are having a colder and snower year, that can be true even if we don't have snow in early December, because what if all that cold and snow hits in March or in April, like it did in, I think, 2023, 2022, I forget which year it was. But the timing of that can really change how we feel about it. And, like, you know, we might still have a brown Christmas, but still a very snowy winter.
Right. Or people that were reporting over this fall that their lilacs were in bloom again. Something different's happening out there.
Which can also be caused by pests or a fungus.
Sure. Which is also you know, has to do with climate and what's going on. So,
yep.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's why we dig into it, more and more questions all the time.
Yep. And yeah, they're just, it's so complex. And I'm glad my job is just to say, hey, look at that. That's cool.
Here's what it might be. And let's think more about it. We're curious folks. That's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
What could be better than listening to the voice of students who have even more curiosity than we do? This week, we've chosen our friends from the North Shore Community School near Duluth.
Yes. They taught me a little something this week. I'm excited about it.
My name is Violet, and I'm your phrenologist for this week. On Wednesday night, November 5th, Miss Urban was about to go to bed when she looked outside and saw the northern lights. They were so bright, and they were easily visible, even though the full moon was out. This week, we noticed lots of plants that are still green, something that's unusual for this time of year. On Monday, November 3rd, Miss Urban noticed round-lobed hepatica that was still green. On Tuesday, November 4th, Miss Rademacher's class noticed more green plants like Western Sweet, Coltsfoot, and Naked Bishop's Cap. Also on Tuesday, the preschoolers noticed the green fronds of Spinulus wood fern and the fertile fronds of a sensitive fern that will release its spores next season on Wednesday, November 5th. The preschoolers noticed green leaves of Canadian bunchberry that had turned purple. On Monday, November 3rd, Miss Urban noticed lots of migrating raptors at school, including bald eagles, rough-legged hawks, and red-tailed hawks. The wind was very strong, so the raptors were probably taking advantage of the good migration conditions. The preschoolers were exploring on Tuesday, November 4th, and found two lobster mushrooms. The mushrooms were not attached to the ground. Perhaps a little animal picked them to eat as a snack. The preschoolers also found a pill bug, which isn't even an insect. It's a crustacean, which means it's closely related to lobsters or shrimp. This concludes the phrenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
That part where pill bugs are crustaceans blew my tiny mind. I had no idea. So we always think of crustaceans as ocean dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least water dwelling.
Right. And delicious dipped in butter.
I'm not a huge shellfish fan, so you're going to be alone on that one.
All right.
That's what people say. But yeah, that was fascinating to me. And so I had to look it up, and sure enough, they're right. And I also found a list of some of the common names for a pill bug, also known as a roly-poly, a woodlouse, a doodlebug, a cellar bug. I can't say that one on air. A bench biter, a chucky pig, a potato bug, cement bug, and then a little soil pig. In Italy, it's called a porcolino di terra.
Wow.
And that just brings me joy.
Something new we learned. Yeah, I've heard a couple of those. The doodle bug, that one? And potato bug. I've heard like on past phenologies too of talking about them. But that just shows us, I mean, they didn't, I mean, and these are preschoolers.
Yeah.
Preschoolers who are questioning a bug and thinking it's maybe not a bug. That's something else. I remember this is going into sort of more of my own territory of letting more story and imagination when it comes to the outdoors, which I think is we can do either or both. But I remember being with a little cousin of mine who asked me very, very seriously if bugs think that we're people or do they think that we're big bugs was the question posed.
I love that question.
There
are so many different parts to that.
I know. I was blown away. I mean, maybe 4 years old when he told me that.
Yeah.
Maybe three. Honestly, it was crazy. So that's one to just ponder over and, you know, write me an essay and get back to me on that one, Charlie.
Maybe I will. I mean, the first question to answer is, do bugs think?
Yeah, yeah.
And then is, what is thinking? And, okay. Next week, we'll be talking about cognition in arthropods. Also, my new band name.
Yes, there we go. We've got a band name coming up for you from Tornado Bob, too, by the way.
Great.
But again, we want to tell you about that. We work with classrooms all around the state of Minnesota, and we broadcast their reports. And if you're curious more about what students are honing in on, those are also available at KXC's website, kxc.org. But we're choosing one each week on the Season Watch pods. You get a feel for it, and I think there's nothing more inspiring than, you know, it doesn't have to be a kid, but someone saying, take a look. Let's look closer. What is this? And just even the story of it all of like that the teacher was about to go to bed when she looked outside and saw the northern lights. They're seeing their teachers as real people there, unlike me when I was freaked out when I would run into a teacher at the grocery store and I didn't know they lived outside the classroom, you know.
Right.
Didn't understand that.
Like, I think that would have been, I had kind of the same experience where my teachers existed in the classroom and like, in sixth grade, I would have had a really hard time conceptually with like the idea that my teacher looked out their bedroom window and saw the northern lights.
Yeah.
Like you exist after 3 p.m. You have a house.
You're not just there for
a window.
Yeah. Oh
my gosh. Yep.
But that's really important because that sort of became the theme of this week, the northern lights and the auroras. And, you know, we have a guy on each week, Tornado Bob. Certain times of the year.
Great name.
He's Aurora Bob, and he is always staying up, not always, but when he can, he stays up all night, drives to places where he can see the northern lights. But this week was a very different thing. But we talked to him a little bit on the KXC morning show about understanding these auroras out there.
Sun's been pretty active this week. This morning, we had another X-class flare. And that has, we can see a big coronal mass ejection associated with that. So we've got a couple of these big flare-associated coronal mass ejections coming at Earth. The first is supposed to arrive this evening. The weather forecast is for cloudy, mostly cloudy, but clearing late. So by morning, it'll be clearing off. Tomorrow, it'll be mostly sunny. And then tomorrow night, it should be clear as well. So
okay.
We should have a good chance if the conditions with the magnetic field orientation within these clouds of plasma that are headed towards us, if the magnetic field orientation is favorable with a magnetic field that opposes Earth's magnetic field, then we'd see more northern lights. And it could be one of those relatively spectacular displays because we have multiple coronal mass ejections on the way.
All right.
So that was like kind of the same conditions that gave us our May 10th and 11th storm last year.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very remarkable one because I was looking south.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I recall now. Yeah, it was full sky.
Full sky. Yeah. And for a while, the northern sky was dark. And then the southern sky was, those were where the lights were.
Wow.
If it gets strong enough and the magnetic field in the solar wind is far enough south, then it'll push the auroras farther south too. Yeah. So they come closer to us, but if they, you know, this case, they went past us a little bit and they were down in southern Minnesota and Iowa.
Yeah.
So you look south to see the northern lights.
Yeah.
Anyway, so active conditions are here and the moon phase is, you know, like last week's auroras, those ones on Wednesday night were on it was a full moon, the brightest full moon of the year. Yeah, that was spectacular. They got really bright for a while. And then this past weekend, we had a gathering of aurora freaks like myself. It was called the Aurora Summit, and I was out at Red Cliff on the Bayfield Peninsula.
Oh, okay.
At the legendary Waters Resort and Casino. So we had a weekend of aurora, just talking about them and photography and the science and everything like that. That was fun.
Aurora Bob there. Once again, providing, not he hasn't, but each week we seem to find a band that Charlie's going to helm. And of course, this week's is the coronal mass ejections. A little weird.
Ah, yes. The old CME, coronal mass ejection. Oh, boy.
So so I'm in northern Minnesota in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. You are in, southeast? Not south exactly.
Yeah, I'm at
south central, I don't know.
About 45 minutes north of the Twin Cities.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Southeastern, yep. And last night, when the northern lights were so bright, I was in the Twin Cities, and we could see, even with light pollution from the cities, we could see them by the naked eye clearly. It was phenomenal.
Well, and we're recording this. Tonight's supposed to be even better, so it's going to be so interesting. And people want to talk. They want to share these photos. And, you know, there's this whole thing of, like, what you see, how different it is when you take the photo and the colors that you see. But this time, to the naked eye, people were seeing colors they hadn't seen before. And I found myself, because I always get mad if, like, I wake up in the morning and all of a sudden I see on social media everybody saw the northern lights. And I didn't realize it. So I texted friends. I texted people I don't know very well to tell them to go outside and look. Because, you know, I went walking out. It was very mild temperatures. There's nothing like walking outside in your pajamas and watching the sky, man. I mean, it's just fantastic. And I just felt connected to people watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was over at a friend's house last night and we knocked on their roommate's door, which we never do, to be like, hey, there are northern lights. You got to come see this. So their roommate came out and we were able to watch them. We saw neighbors outside that we never see, or like we sometimes see in their yard, but we certainly never talk to. And we were all oohing and aahing and taking pictures through the cameras and wondering why the camera looks so different from what our naked eye sees. You know, my chat with my family was blowing up with aurora pictures. And it's just such a cool, it's the delight in nature that we talk about all the time, but it feels like everyone's just connected in this way of awe and wonder.
Well, and so many people saw it last night. And I was also using the phrase naked eye a lot because I was getting, you know, friends that were like only 2 miles away from me and they're in town. I'm close to town. And so we have some light pollution, but I wasn't seeing the full on reds. I was seeing more greens and they were pointing It was like straight over our barn and it felt like the green shoots were like pointing to a star or a planet. We thought it was maybe Jupiter, but not sure what it was, but it was a whole different sort of thing. Then we saw a little bit of red, but I'm asking my friends, like, is that red naked eye? You know, did you see the red in the sky? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, we could this time. You know, so this whole confusing thing of like, they're not very far away and why are they seeing it differently than I'm seeing it? And then why this camera thing of how different it is?
I mean, talk about sparking curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that really does it. And, you know, I had a lot of those same questions last night. And so, because of who I am, I was looking it up. And I did find some answers. with the camera picking it up so differently than our naked eye does, which is such an odd idiom, naked eye.
Yeah, but it is.
I don't need to be distracted by that right now.
Except that I was wearing glasses, so is that a naked eye? I don't know.
Right? What kind of clothes do you put onto your eye? Contacts.
Yeah.
Okay. Charlie, focus. Cameras. Northern Lights. Yes.
There we go.
Okay. The reason that our cameras pick it up so differently than our eyes do is because with technology being what it is now, our camera's sensitivity to light is now more sensitive, is able to pick up more light in dark situations than our eyes are able to. It also has the bonus of you can take pictures with a longer exposure. So it basically means that the camera's metaphorical eye remains open, gathering more light for longer. And we shockingly don't have that capability in our eyes. Our eyes have what is essentially converts to a frame rate of like 60 images per second, which is why a lot of times our movies and stuff are filmed at 60 frames per second. But so yeah, we don't have any control over our exposure length or our sensitivity to light, but our cameras do. And that's why we can see all of these different colors. I'm looking at my pictures from last night and I saw a lot of red. And with my eyes, I could see a lot of red. I could see the greens that I saw in the camera looked more white and weren't as visible. And so I was curious about that too. I found this great article on NASA.gov about how the different colors are formed, where essentially we have like all this energy coming from the coronal mass ejection. and when that hits the atoms in our atmosphere, like oxygen, nitrogen, so on, all that energy causes those atoms to glow. And so the way that it glows in different parts of our atmosphere creates different color. So if an oxygen atom is hit above 120 miles above the Earth, it causes red. And so those red colors are very, very high in the sky and therefore can be seen from further away. Blues and greens happen kind of mid-atmosphere. Nitrogen glows blue. Oxygen atom in like the 60 to 120 miles above the surface of the Earth range will grow green instead of red. And then below 60 miles, nitrogen molecules glow pink instead of blue.
Oh boy.
And so all of those added together create all these different effects and kind of explain why, depending on where you are, you may be seeing different colors.
Wow.
What?
Sometimes I feel like when I see the photo, it's so different than what you see with, again, the naked eye, which I think that's a better band name for you, actually, the naked eyes,
okay,
than the coronal mass ejections. But, you know, that yeah, we'll put a poll up, I guess, maybe about something like mm-hmm. that. But sometimes I feel like it's a trick, right? Like that maybe that's not there, that the camera's just taking this picture this way. When I'm thinking about this wrong, it's not a trick. The camera, I mean, this whole thing of how we process color and how much we can see at one time and what's actually happening, it's no trick. It's
no, it's not.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, we use technology to heighten our senses
mm-hmm.
all the time, but we don't really think about it that way. And I think the way that we use it with the Northern Lights is just so much more obvious.
Hmm.
Like we use microphones to listen to stuff that we would never otherwise be able to hear. You know, even last week when we were talking about the game cameras,
yeah,
letting us see wildlife right. that we would otherwise never be able to see. Hmm. We live in a time where we are able to really expand our senses beyond ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's another way.
It's an interesting thing to be talking about tech. I mean, I guess we're kind of talking about AI in a weird way, aren't we? A little bit. I mean, it's all a little artificial.
I don't know. I think of this stuff as like artificial sensory or like artificial yeah. senses more than intelligence.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, we're thinking about do bugs think?
Yeah.
I don't think my camera is thinking when right. it's capturing those like light.
No. It's not thinking, but it's processing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, we don't need to get into that now for a further episode of Season Watch Pod. We want to thank you for being with us again. We want you to, you know, you can't send a photo over the speak pipe or through a voice memo, but you can send us photos. You can email seasonwatch@kaxe.org. You can tell us the experience. Did you connect with different people because of the Northern Lights? Leave us a voice memo. Look for that speak pipe link at the podcast platforms or on our webpage. We want to let you know that this is a production of KEXE KBXE. We are the first rural community radio station in the nation, about to celebrate 50 years on the air and now digital. And we want to thank the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund for the funding for conversations like what you're hearing, and especially when it comes to students. Thanks also goes out, of course, to the members of KAXE.
The Wild River State Park, the soundscape we listened to at the beginning, was provided by Jonathan Jongsma through Zeno Canto, and the Sandhill Crane from that same recorder, also through Zeno Canto. So thank you, Jonathan Jongsma.
What do you want to leave us with today, Charlie?
You know, we were talking earlier about the Sandhill Cranes. Let's listen to that prehistoric sounding call.